Orale, bienvenidos and welcome to a special edition of the Familia FFP podcast. I'm Jorge Georgie Martin. Today we're joined by someone who's become a fixture on the airwaves in LA for more than two decades. He and I met for probably about 15 years ago, became friends, and he's hosted pre- and post-game shows for the Lakers and the Dodgers. And for the past 8 years, he's been one of the voices of KPCC's Take Two. Hey, Martinez, thanks so much for joining us. Amigo, es un gran placer.
Oh, thanks for having me. I can't wait to talk fantasy. I'll take any opportunity to talk fantasy. Give me some break from news.
Oh, man. Well, we're gonna go back in the memory bank a little bit first before we get into the fantasy side. But, you know, it's been 20 plus years of you into this whole thing. I mean, I remember you once told me you wanted to start out as a sports writer. When did the broadcast thing kind of become your true calling?
It was Cal State Northridge. I had just graduated, summer 95. And I had clips. You're my age, more or less. You know what newspaper clips are. You'd make a folder of some of your work from your college newspaper, and you'd send it out to newspapers across the country, hoping that one of them will say, yes, let's give this unproven kid a try. So I had a bunch of them already stamped and ready to get mailed out. I had a cold crate of them. And I wanted to make one last stop to the Cal State Northridge journalism office, which unfortunately after the earthquake was a trailer. The journalism building, I never got to set foot in that thing because of the earthquake in 94. And I walked in, and the person answering the phones had just put the phone down and was writing something down. And then she got up and put a piece of paper on the board. So I thought, let's see what that is. So I went up to see it and said, board operator needed extra sports 690. Here's the phone number. And that was the old sports station that that Jim Rome was on, based in Baja California. Lee Hacksaw Hamilton. I mean, just if you're a sports radio nut from the 80s and 90s, you'll know extra sports 690. I gave it a call. The guy said, can you come down right now? We can interview you right now. And I said, well, I'm dressed in shorts and a t-shirt. He said, don't worry, it's sports radio. Come on down. So I went on down. He interviewed me. He said, hey, well, can we train you today? Sure. Okay, great. Things are moving so fast. I'm just like, I'm thrilled. They put me behind a board. They had me watch the guy that was board hopping the show, which is the radio engineer who makes sure that the levels for the hosts and the shows are okay. And I was watching all this. After about an hour, the guy said, let's get in the chair and see how you do. And this is back in the day where we don't have any of the digital things that we have today back then. It was all dials and tape, and you had to splice things with a razor and put tape on it. That's how long ago, a million years ago. I think I was Marconi's intern. That's how long ago it felt. But they got me going on that. And right off the bat, it felt really great to be in a live kind of environment. I newspaper writing is a little different. Yeah, you're covering a game and you write your story and you get your quotes. But back then, this is 95, your work wouldn't show up until the next day, the next morning when people read it. This was immediate. Radio was happening now. People were talking now. They were doing the same things I might have been doing for a newspaper article, but in the moment, in the now. And luckily for me, the guys that I was observing, Steve Mason and John Ireland, Mason and Ireland, the show that's been going on longer than I've been doing journalism, they brought me in right away, gave me a nickname, A Martinez, because A is not my real name. But they made me part of things right away, and it felt so great. I never sent out any of those envelopes with my clips. I never sent them out. It was so intoxicating that I thought, well, I'll send them out later. And that later never came. And that's how I started in radio and started evolving the career.
Yeah, you mentioned how Mason gave you the nickname. How often do you get called by your given name? And
my mom, my grandma, and my wife. That's it. That's it. Because everyone else has a different name for me. So everyone in radio calls me A. My kids call me Dad. My grandkids call me Papa. So the actual name, George, that hardly ever exists anymore in my life.
How often do you hear from Mason in Ireland?
Not often. I mean, we you know, I'm on when they're on, I think. I think that's sports radio schedules changes so often, but I think we're on at the same time. We'll text occasionally here and there because Mason is such a movie freak and I'm a movie freak too. We'll text about movies. And then when the Lakers season comes around, I'll text Ireland here and there about some things. But yeah, they're my radio fathers. I think a lot of how I am on the air, whether it's doing sports or doing news, I think a lot of their personality rubbed off on me on how to have my on-air persona. They didn't have to bring me in. They didn't have to include me. They didn't have to. My first radio microphone experience was, it's 1996, and that's when MLS, Major League Soccer, was born. And I was all into Major League Soccer. And they said, hey, well, can you do a Major League Soccer report for the show? Great. I did it live. It was awesome. And then Ireland on a whim said, well, do it in Spanish. And I did it in Spanish. The exact thing I just said. So it's, they gave me opportunity. They brought me along with them when they didn't have to. So I'll always appreciate them for that.
The Dodger years kind of came along right after Mason in Ireland, when you worked for the station that acquired the Dodgers rights. What was it like for you to be alongside Vin Scully, Jaime Jarrín, Hall of Famers like that, and then later local legends like Ross Porter and Rick Monday and Charlie Steiner? What was that like for you?
My first day in Dodger Town in Vero Beach, Florida, the very first day I show up there. Well, I showed up the night before, so I was so excited I could barely sleep because all I kept doing is staring, at the darkness, because you've been to Dodger Town, that yep. At night there's very little light. It is just dark, but I know that there's baseball fields everywhere, so I couldn't stop thinking about walking into Holman Stadium and seeing all that the next day. So the next day I get up, I'm ready to go. They say everyone has breakfast. It was a dining hall where the minor leaguers would have breakfast and a lot of the staff at Dodger Town would have breakfast. I walk in and I get my tray. It's kind of like a buffet cafeteria style thing. Uh-huh. And I get my eggs, my bacon, orange juice. The orange juice in Florida, that's as top notch as you can get. I mean, it's Indian River orange juice, which is it's the best orange juice in the world. So I'm nervous and I'm walking into the dining room and I there's no one in there, but I figure I better just find myself a corner, somewhere in the corner where no one will see me and say, what are you doing here? Get out, go back to LA. You shouldn't be here. I was just so nervous to be kicked out of the place. So I go all the way to the corner and I sit down and start having my meal. And then coming out of the same line that I came out of is Jaime Jarrín, who's Ecuadorian, who I listened to before I listened to Vin as a kid because my family's from Ecuador. So he's a hero to me and my family. Uh-huh. He comes out. Now, I'd met him before, right? But now I'm in Dodger Town, which is a completely different experience than just meeting him, out on the street. And he says, Jorge, ven acá, ven, siéntate conmigo. I was like, oh, okay. So I'm nervously grabbing my tray, shaking, because I can't believe that I'm going to have breakfast with Jaime Jarrín, a Hall of Famer, right? So I'm bringing my tray over. I said, oh, gracias, gracias. And I sit down and I start to eat. And we just talk about, the day. He's like, what do you think of the place? What have you seen? And I'm trying to put one word together because I'm just so happy and nervous at the same time. So a few minutes go by, and then in walks Vin Scully, who then sits at that front table. Now, Jorge, you know that front table at Dodger Town. It's really reserved for the people that should be there, like Vin Scully and Jaime Jarrín. So now Vin walks up, and he sits his tray down. Now he's sitting there. So I'm like, okay. I'm at a table with Jaime Jarrín and Vin Scully. Like, okay, life can end now. It can end, and I'd be happy. The Dodgers were playing the Reds that day. A few minutes later, in walks Sparky Anderson, who goes through the same line, sits down. And I'm like, okay, how many more Hall of Famers are going to sit at this table? And I feel I shouldn't be there. There was a cavalcade of Hall of Famers sitting at this table with me. And that's my childhood dream come true. I mean, it was my childhood dream come true to see all of these people that I grew up reading about, listening to, and just one day hoping to even be in the same airspace with them. That was my first experience in the Dodger world. It was just amazing.
And it's funny. I have my stories like that. It's just, it is so amazing when you're in that, and it's so normal for them, and they welcome you into that space. And it's just like, it's almost like a that immediate rite of passage. And you're a part of that, you know, Tommy loves to say once a Dodger, always a Dodger. And you're kind of in that space. It's amazing. I mean, Jaime is still such a cherished friend, and incredible. Thank you for sharing that one. I mean, we could go on and on, but I know this will be a 3-hour thing, but the Laker years, you know, doing the pre and post game show, you got to see some incredible teams in there. What were some of the things that stuck out about those years being so embedded in the team?
The number one thing was watching the Lakers beat the Celtics the second time around, the Kobe Gasol years. Remember when Gasol got traded from Memphis to LA? That catapulted them to the finals. I don't think anybody really expected the Lakers. They were a good team, but no one expected them to get to the finals. The Celtics were just so dominant, and the Celtics beat them that year, 4-2 in that series. But then the Lakers go back and beat Orlando. And I was there doing, you know, Lakers line for that. But it didn't, the loss to the Celtics still stung. You know, growing up in LA, you're a Dodger, you're a Laker fan. It's like they go together, like being someone from New York and you're a Yankees and Knicks fan. They just match. They fit. And then the following year, the third year, that's when the Lakers and Celtics, it seems like, starting to have another collision course. And that's all I was rooting for. I was like, please let it be the Celtics. Please let it be the Celtics. And it turned out that it was. And that series was one of the most emotional up and down series that any Laker fan has ever gone through. Because if you remember that last game, Kobe had a terrible game. Kobe was, you could tell that he was emotionally and physically spent. He had nothing left, but Kobe always gives everything he's got and more. If it wasn't for Ron Artest, Metta World Peace, the Lakers would not have beaten the Celtics that year. So that game 7, the way it was won, and the fact that they were able to just get one from those hated green monsters over there in Beantown, that was worth it all. That was the high point for me, because after that, then you know, the Lakers had an up and down kind of history after that. You know, the success didn't last, and then they had the long period of drought, not, you know, what it is today. But that stood out to me the most. Beating the Celtics, it had to be them, because any other team, the satisfaction wouldn't have been there.
I still remember that game and just being like, it's funny because that game kind of reminded me of Jordan's final game, game 6 of the 98, where Jordan was not good for the first 46 minutes, but he made like several plays in the last 2 minutes that won the game. And Kobe made a couple of plays, but yeah, that Ron Artest 3-pointer was no. Yes.
It's tough to trust Artest, but yeah, and I was doing that show, that post game show, because I did the pre inside Staples Center. The post game was inside the ESPN Zone restaurant that's across the street from Staples Center.
Oh man.
So I'm in the middle of just this packed restaurant, like just like a few hundred yards away from where this is actually happening, and fans are banging on the glass of the studio. Now, that glass isn't typical radio station glass that's so thick that you could bang on it and the person inside wouldn't hear it. No, this was thin glass. So everyone, I was just hands just slapping on the glass like a hockey game. It was an intense, intense broadcast once the Lakers won that game.
Oh man, what an awesome memory. Yeah, that one, I actually watched that game with the same friend I watched the 85 championship when the Lakers beat the Celtics for the first time. So that was special. That was special. Let's go to 2012. The move to KPCC was a big, you know, shift for you professionally. You know, Take Two wanted to connect more with the Latino audience and more of the culture that is in LA. What were some of the early lessons that have really stuck with you, that have kind of really made the show what it is today and become so popular?
Well, the lesson for me was how much of a news novice I was. I was so elbow deep in sports, and in sports radio is combat radio in a way. You know, if you're not on your game, if you don't know what you're talking about, if you don't construct an argument, the host next to you or the caller that you're that you're talking to will take you down. They get pleasure out of taking you down. That's the whole point of sports radio. It's very aggressive, and that's what makes it fun. In news, though, you know, I didn't realize. I mean, I kept up with current events, and I thought, okay, well, that should be enough for a foundation. It wasn't. When it comes to politics, when it comes to policy, even culture, and especially in a place as large and diverse as Los Angeles, that is a you have to dive in all the way and get completely wet situation. And I didn't realize how much out of my depth I was when I started. I thought, hey, I'm born and raised in LA. I should be able to handle this fine. I wasn't. And it took a while. It took a while to get in the flow. It's like, you know, you and I could rattle off some Dodger, you know, history or Dodger statistic from 1988, but it's not so easy to think of like, okay, what was the Christopher Commission after, you know, Rodney King verdict? You know, that wasn't so easy to break down as it is now after I've spent time diving in. So yeah, that was the first lesson for me was how uninformed I was on the things that were non-sports related in Los Angeles. And I didn't realize how large of a depth there was to Los Angeles because I was just so involved in the sports part of this city. So that was the main lesson that I had to kind of get up to speed as quickly as possible.
What do you think's been kind of like one of your keys to connecting with audiences over the years?
For me, and I think this is true for any radio host, anyone that's broadcasting, whether it's TV, podcast, radio, is, you know, show them who you are. You know, let them hear who you are. You know, everyone makes a choice. Every performer makes a choice. Like, do I want to show a persona or do you want to show the person? And I think, you know, Howard Stern has made a career out of showing the person. You know, Howard kind of lays it all out there. And while obviously for, you know, in public radio, no one's going to be Howard Stern on KPCC or on NPR, but there is a sense of being able to not be the stuffy presenter, the stuffy broadcaster, where there's a disconnect. I am telling you the news. Here it is, like Moses coming down from the mountain, right, with the Ten Commandments. That is what you don't want, and especially today. It was that way in 2012, but it's especially true today because I think people want to hear who you are. And as a journalist, you have a choice to like let people know what you stand for, or do you let your work let people know what you stand for? And so there are ways to do it where you connect with people where they understand that, yeah, you're one of them. You're one of their neighbors. You live in their neighborhood. And by that, I mean Los Angeles, Southern California. That's why I always say this all the time on the air, that take two is about knowing what's going on with your neighbors and neighborhood. And that's not micro, that's not granular, it's macro. We're all in this Southern California neighborhood. Different people, different experiences. And I think if as a broadcaster, you let people know who you are and what you're about, they're more willing to tell you about them and who they are and what they're about. And that's how I get to the core of finding out what's going on with your neighbors and neighborhood.
Oh, that's awesome. Oh, thank you. That kind of sums it up. And you know what? That's something I always felt about you. You were always authentic in everything. You always things came across in all the years that I've known you. All right, let's talk fantasy. How long have you played fantasy football? And kind of tell me about that early show that you hosted on Sunday mornings.
So I got into fantasy. Actually, it didn't happen until I left the Dodgers and went to ESPN. That was 2008. I'd never played fantasy. I knew about it. I knew it existed. But I don't know why somehow I wasn't drawn to it. I thought maybe because I was so deep in the baseball world that maybe I didn't need it. But it was 2008, and I was working on Steve Mason's show. I think John had left for like a year. There was some kind of dispute with the station, and he had left for the year. And Mason asked me, hey, do you want to join our fantasy baseball league here? And for the longest time, I kind of poo-pooed fantasy. I was like, well, that's for geeks. You know, that's for geeks. I know I did because I thought, well, you know, so it's okay. But I did it. I wanted to be, you know, I was in a new place. I'd left, you know, traveling with the Dodgers, and I wanted to, you know, make friends and do some of the same things they were doing, especially fun things. And I figured it would be a good way to keep up with the daily baseball news. Considering at ESPN, I was covering all kinds of things, I saw it as a mechanism to stay in the know. And that first draft, because when you open one of those draft windows, if you've never seen a draft window before, it can be a little intimidating. There's so much information. You see faces of players, you see different rounds, who's drafting, stats that you can call up, different ways to evaluate who you're going to pick. You have to know the rules of the league that you're in, because you might pick a player that you think, well, he's a superstar, but he might not fit for the rules and scoring system of the league that you happen to be in. Yeah. It's intimidating. And I was so nervous with my first pick that I rolled over and didn't pick the guy I wanted to pick. I picked Curtis Granderson with my first pick. I had the number one pick, the first pick in the entire draft, and this is 2008. Curtis Granderson, solid player, and he was actually a pretty good player back in 2008, but he wasn't the first overall pick in the draft, and I picked him. And then everyone in the message boards, in the when everyone talks crap to each other, like, Curtis Granderson, what the hell are you doing? Like, I don't know. This is the first time I've ever picked. So, yeah, that was my first experience with that, is kind of trying to get to know not just the information, but the mechanics, because you have to you kind of help yourself out to know the mechanics of each individual window and platform too. ESPN's draft board looks different than Yahoo, and Yahoo looks different than CBS Sports. And yeah, so that's what you have to know if you're going to go in and start playing fantasy, whether it's football, baseball, basketball, hockey, any kind of fantasy.
And the show was, how much did that help you talking with the audience, kind of learning what people are thinking on, especially on Sunday morning when they're going to be setting up their lineups?
Well, I'll give you, that Sunday morning show was actually the offshoot of what I was doing with my nightly show on ESPN. Eventually I evolved to doing the show 6 to 10 Monday through Friday nights. And by this time now, I'm playing fantasy all the time. I'm involved in just lots of football, baseball, basketball, even hockey leagues. Fantasy is a big part of my life. And I was thinking about a way where I could talk fantasy, but still have it be sports talk, because that was some of the early resistance to talking fantasy on TV or radio, in that it would sound too geekish. It wouldn't sound like sports talk. So I was thinking about a way, well, how can I do this in a way where we get information out, we still talk about the things that I would normally talk about in a sports radio show, but make it about fantasy. So I thought to myself, okay, it was an experiment that I tried on a Monday, the last 15 minutes of my show. I wanted to look ahead to Sunday's football games. And I thought of the show Entourage. You know how they say, let's hug it out? Uh-huh. Because I came up with this thing called Let's Talk It Out, because when someone has a fantasy question, right, how do you figure out what you're going to do with fantasy? You try and find someone and bounce the idea off of them. So like, you want to say like, well, should I pick Terrell Owens facing the Eagles on grass at 1 o'clock? It's a road game for the 49ers. There is so much there, right, that you need to factor in. The weather, it's a West Coast team flying to the East Coast, that the only way to really do it is to talk to someone about it, to talk it out, hug it out, talk it out. So what I would do is I'd say, hey, Sunday, week 6 of the NFL, I'm sure you got questions about what you want to do based on what happened last week. Give me a call. I gave the number out. And let's talk it out. Let's talk it out. We'll bounce ideas off each other. I'll try to help you, and we'll see what happens. I said that, and the entire board lit up immediately, like a Christmas tree, right up. Like, whoa. And I wasn't equipped to handle that. I was thinking like one guy maybe would call up. Not only one guy, women were calling up with questions about their works fantasy team, fantasy league that they're in. They would have all kinds of questions. And now, a lot of the time for fantasy, I think when it comes to fantasy questions, you just want confirmation for what you already want to do. You want someone to say, yeah, that's good. That's good. You should do that. So that's part of it, is to kind of get a feeling like I'm making the right move. Because in the end, I mean, it's all a guess. It's all a guess. You could factor in every bit of stat, wind speed, weather. It's all one guess. But there are also educated guesses where you narrow down as much of the specifics as you can. And people were calling up and they were saying, okay, it's the Bears defense. Which two running backs should I start? You know, and they'll give me the option of the running back playing the Bears or a running back playing a different defense. And it's all talking it out. And in that moment, we were able to talk fantasy. We were able to talk actual, you know, game plan sports, because, you know, what's a plan of attack, right? A plan of attack is what this running back will do against the Bears defense that'll help his team win, and what that means for the Bears as a, or for that guy's team overall in the context of the season and the playoffs. It all became one big sports jumble, but the focus of it was helping out this guy's fantasy team.
Oh, this is incredible. This is incredible. And that
morphed into, so that 15 minutes in a week became the last half hour of my show. A few months later, it became the last hour of the show, and then it became the last 2 hours of the show. And I could have done it the entire show, the whole show, and people would have called. People would have wanted questions. I started, like, getting questions on Twitter. I started getting questions, just in every possible social media aspect about what to do about a trade, an acquisition. Should I drop this guy? Should I hold on to him? It became completely the entire focus of the show, because people love playing fantasy. They love pretending that they can put together a team, just like a general manager in a real team would do.
How have you seen it kind of even explode in the years that since you started playing in 12 years ago?
Oh, it's gotten a lot more scientific. It's always been stat-based. I mean, that was the old perception of it, that it's just for geeks, because, well, yeah, if you know, stats do tell a story, and they tell a story of repetition. So that's how scouting reports work a lot of the time. When you use statistical analysis, if you throw a guy a curveball on an 0-2 count, and the stats show that he typically, you know, rolls that ball over to the first baseman, then what are you going to do when you see him with an 0-2 count? If you're a pitcher, you're going to throw him a curveball, because the stats say that that tends to be what happens. That all of that applies in fantasy, where we're trying to predict things using the numbers of these people's history as athletes. So that's how it became something that became a bit of a pejorative, like, stat geeks. I'm a real sports fan. I don't do those stats things. Well, guess what? In the last 12 years, it has become something that's been so just integral in terms of how people analyze sports and see sports and consume sports and enjoy sports, that now it's no longer for geeks anymore. Doing the stats is the fun part of it. It's not the math homework assignment that no one wants to do. It's the stuff that you gladly do because you want to win. You want to win the pot. You want to beat your friends. That's the biggest change.
How about for you? How have your strategies evolved?
What I tend to do now, here's the thing. So what I used to do is I would invite, or I would accept any invitation of any listener who invited me to a fantasy team. There was a couple of years where I was in hundreds of fantasy leagues, hundreds of fantasy leagues. The thing was, for the most part, fantasy leagues share the same rules. You got to have someone that's really into the league to really go deep into the settings and kind of personalize settings, really customize settings. And that's another level of fantasy. But for the most part, you know, when someone does a fantasy league at work, you know, they just take the standard setup that's offered. They don't want to make it too complicated. They want to, you know, make it inviting for people. And generally people play, you know, for the same reason that I played at ESPN, to kind of get to know my coworkers, to get to know, you know, my neighborhood. You know, it's like, it's this thing where you don't want to make it so deep that people get turned off by it. You want to make it inviting, you know, something that people want to do, as opposed to a chore that people feel they have to do. When it comes to strategies, if the league rules are generally the same across the board, I will draft the same team for pretty much every single league. The only time I'll deviate is if there's a rule change or a scoring change that is so different that I have to account for it. And that's why you always have to make sure you are well-versed on the scoring settings of any fantasy league you're in. Don't assume that it's just like the one at work, because it might be completely different. And the guy that you draft in one league is not near as valuable as he would be in a different league. So that's the key thing to always understand when you play fantasy, is that all players are not scored the same depending on the fantasy league.
So do you have a favorite format, standard, PPR, super flex?
Wow, for football, well, there's one that I play in where it is not points per reception, which it's amazing to me because that feels like a dinosaur time, right? It feels like, but yeah, there is no, so I have to remind myself that in that league, like, it wouldn't be a great idea to take someone like Wes Welker back in the day, because he would almost be kind of useless compared to someone that scores a lot of touchdowns. Like someone like, say, Davante Adams, who had that year where he scored like 16, 17 touchdowns. If I were to put him face up against the old Wes Welker that would make like 120 catches, he wouldn't be as valuable, right? Wes Welker, you think, oh my God, that's overwhelming, 100 catches. No, because there's no points per every reception, so the guy that scores the touchdowns is the guy that's more valuable. Yeah, it's something that you really, everyone needs to be completely keen on to make sure that you know what you're doing. But yeah, I do prefer the ones with a lot of bonuses. Like say a 100-yard bonus for running backs and receivers, a 400-yard bonus for quarterbacks. But I love bonuses because that in a league can swing things. Like say for a field goal kicker, and now, you know, that's obviously evolving in the NFL, which will evolve in fantasy as well. But say, so back in the day, if I would set up leagues where if someone kicked a 50-yard plus field goal, they would get the points for the field goal, but they would get an extra 3 points for kicking one that far. And when you're watching your matchup, and you know that guy just hit the field goal and that 3 points adds up, and then three more points adds up in addition, that rush that you get, woo!
It's like getting a touchdown from a kicker.
Yeah. It's bonuses. That any league that has bonuses, and I always set up bonuses, that's the ones that I like the most.
I'm still waiting to see a league that has a setting for a 60-yard field goal, a 60-plus yard field goal.
Yeah, it's always 50-plus. So yeah, but it's got someday, right? It would have to happen.
Because it seems like it's like once a season or once every other season, a kicker gets a 60-yard field goal. I did not think we'd be getting into kicker talk today.
Oh, yeah. And the other part, too, is I love making sure that every league that I design has negative points. So if a field goal kicker misses a field goal, get a deduction. If there's a drop pass, deduction. Fumbles, deductions. A lot of defenses. If you do a team defense, sometimes a lot of people don't want to put the deductions in terms of like points allowed or yards allowed. I make sure that, yeah, if you're going to choose a defense, you got to make sure that defense has a good day. It's because defenses are routinely, you know, added and dropped throughout the season all the time, because people usually draft those things last. Kicker and defense are the ones that are draft last, yep, in most fantasy leagues. But if you've got a great deal, like a few years ago, the Bears had such an overwhelmingly great defense that they'd win some games. The Patriots defense from last season was putting up these amazing fantasy numbers. You know, when it comes to takeaways, interceptions, fumble recovery, scoring, because special teams is attached to it. If you want to go just week to week on a defense and try to take advantage of a good matchup, if that defense gets torched, you need to pay the price. You need to pay the price for trying to kind of vulture a matchup with a defense. So that's why I always include a lot of negatives, a lot of points taken away, just to defend against someone trying to do a quick smash and grab on a defense for a week.
Especially because, like, you know, there are games where, like, that classic Rams Chiefs game from 2018,
oh, yeah,
both defenses scored a lot of points because they got pick sixes, but they both gave up 50 plus points. So, that was amazing. So, we're to talk about players. Where would you stand on picking Patrick Mahomes or Lamar Jackson early, like the second round?
Well, I have in one keeper league, I have Lamar Jackson and Christian McCaffrey, and I can keep three players. Those are the only two I'm keeping. I'm definitely keeping Lamar Jackson because of the rush touchdowns. Yeah. If you've got a league that allows for the quarterback to get credit for the rush touchdowns and the passing touchdowns, Lamar Jackson is, if you took him in the first round, I would not raise an eyebrow. because he is that. I mean, and I know it's just one, it's a quarterback, it's one guy, but he can be a difference maker, an absolute difference maker. Mahomes too. Mahomes is going to throw 40 to 50 touchdowns, maybe run for a few as well. With this era's running quarterbacks that use that as a scoring weapon, not just as a way to gain yardage, because for me in fantasy, if a quarterback has 100 yards rushing, unless there's a bonus attached to it, I could care less. But if on the 6-yard line, they're a threat to roll out and tuck it and die for it, that is, yeah. Those guys are so worth it. So Russell Wilson, depending on the kind of league you're in, they are definitely at the very least third rounders. In some leagues, depending on the scoring, second rounders. But Lamar Jackson, for me, if you took him in the first round, I'd be like, yep, me too. Absolutely.
He got more yards rushing. He was top 10 in rushing yards just by himself. So that means he's a running back. Yeah, it's very easy to justify picking him in the first round. So my last one is any sleepers you're talking about that you're targeting for the upcoming season?
The ones I typically, and I, like, this would be like deep, deep sleeper talk here. Anyone coming back from an injury that is put in a really good situation. So, like, if you can believe it, a few years ago, if I would have said that at one point David Johnson would be a sleeper, I'd get laughed out of every single room, right? But he is technically now a really good sleeper candidate because he has had an injury plague last few years. That one great season that he has feels like a mirage. He's still, age-wise, still in that sweet spot for a running back. He hasn't hit 30 yet, so he'd be someone that I'd be looking at. So people are going to pass on him. People are going to pass on him because of the injury history, and rightfully so. Completely understand. But if you're sitting around there, say, like, 6th, 7th round, you're maybe not too thrilled with the running backs that are left or the running backs you got, hey, I give him a try. Give him a try. Nothing is better than a guy, a talented guy with a chip on his shoulder who has something to prove. And that this year, that is David Johnson.
No, I'm targeting Aaron Rodgers that way. It seems like he's falling down ADP right now. He's like QB12 on a lot of leagues. So I hear you. Yeah, grab that guy. Grab those undervalued guys. Those are the guys that win you leagues. The first rounders, the first and second rounders, all they do is put you up like you're going to win the league. It's the people you take after the second round that actually win the league for you. And
always know the offensive coordinator's philosophy, like what they like doing with players. I mean, it's something. I mean, you got to do studying. I mean, that's the only way to really, if you're in a competitive fantasy league, that's the really only way to have to give yourself a good shot to win. Understand the coach. Understand the offensive coordinator, the game plan, what they do, what they like to do, and then that's where you find the sleepers, because that's where you find wide receivers that maybe going into this season like, wow, he's a nobody, but wait, in that system with that offensive coordinator, with that quarterback who maybe likes seeing a guy in the slot, and if it's a PPR league, will maybe toss him, you know, 6 to 7 attempts a game, maybe he catches 4 or 5 of them. And those are those little incremental gains, those marginal gains that could push you over the top every week by a point or two. And at that point, it doesn't matter. As long as you get the W, that's all that matters. And then those incremental points at the end of the season, if that turns out to be a tiebreaker, you're going to wish you had them. So yeah, it takes a lot of studying, not just looking at the draft window and see who's projected to score this amount of points for the season. Know the player, know his contract situation. Is he looking for a new contract? You know, is the offensive coordinator someone that will use someone like him? Know those things to have the edge. I mean, that's the only way to truly feel that you've given yourself a shot to win, especially in a league that has serious players in it and has a big enough pot.
Oh man. Hey, this has been awesome. I think we could go on forever, ever. I think we may have to have you be a guest analyst here and there once we get into the season.
If there's a season, right? Because that's who knows.
Well, I've got my mom setting veladoras all the time for for both baseball and football to happen. So yeah. Let's hope. Hey, thank you so much. Thank you so much. Gosh, it's been too long since we caught up. Thank you. This has been awesome. We'll be doing blog posts on this as well. So two hits out there. So everybody, Otra vez, thank you for tuning in to the Familia FFB podcast. Check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Familia FFB. Where can we find you?
You can find me at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. KPCC 89.3 KPCC Monday through Friday at 2:00. And call me back anytime, because believe me, I love talking fantasy. My biggest flaw in fantasy is that I love talking about fantasy so much that I'll even talk to my opponent on how to beat me, because I might get an idea out of it. So yeah, call me back anytime you want.
That's my fatal flaw too. Hey, thank you, brother. Yeah. Thank you.